You're listening to Civic from the San Francisco Public Press. On this edition, we'll go back to basics on the school board, zooming out from the controversies to get a better understanding of what the school board actually does and how it works.
Pre-Prop 13, school boards could raise local taxes. So there was a lot more interest in who was on that school board. Now, post-Prop 13, you don't see business people or a wide range of people running for the school boards like you used to, because they have limited that power in terms of raising taxes and things like that. You have less of an interest in running for those positions, combined with sort of less experience in the people that might want to run. And so all of these things combined lead into who runs for the school board and who is elected to the school board.
I'm Laura Wenis, and this is Civic. This week, recall efforts aimed at unseating three members of the San Francisco School Board appeared to have reached the number of signatures that they need. The recall campaign will submit those signatures to the city soon, and the elections department will then have a month to verify them. In an election that could be scheduled for late this year or early next year, voters would be asked whether or not they want to remove the board president, Gabriela Lopez, vice president, Fanga Molinga, and member, Allison Collins. This recall attempt came after a variety of controversies involving the board, including frustration about school closures during the pandemic, the board working on renaming schools, and ending merit-based admissions at Lowell High School. Back in May, I talked with two local journalists who cover education in San Francisco about what the school board actually does and why selecting its members is an important but sometimes overlooked task for voters. Jill Tucker is an education writer for the San Francisco Chronicle, and Ida Mojadad is a reporter with the San Francisco Examiner. So let's talk about the school board. The school board, it has seven members. They're elected. They serve four-year terms. The board determines policy for all public K through 12 schools. It sets educational goals. It sets standards. It sets the curriculum. It also sets the district budget, which is independent of the city's budget. And it confirms appointment of all personnel and approves purchases and contracts, including with unions. And the board appoints a superintendent. This is, in very broad strokes, you know, what the board does. But so much of what we hear about is the controversies. I wanted to talk about, the board has these long meetings that most news consumers do not have the time or interest in sitting through. Did I miss any key responsibilities that the school has, that the school board has, that you're paying attention to? And what kind of work has been going on in the background while these controversies and so, you know, are unfolding?
They also oversee the charter school authorizations. They are, because San Francisco is a city and a county, SFUSD is also the Office of County Education as well.
Right. And I would say more informally, you know, they set the tone for the school district in terms of, you know, what types of policies they focus on or what direction they want to take the district. So, while they set the budget, while they set policies, those would align with a political leaning or priorities that the board sets as well.
So the school board is still meeting. I mean, while all this stuff is going on, people are reading about that, you know, is important, but is very, very charged. The board is still meeting. What kind of work are they doing on a day-to-day basis?
Well, they have been meeting just like all public entities. They've been meeting online in Zoom for public meetings and committee meetings since the start of the pandemic, and have been working on, you know, like all school boards across the region, a lot of different issues. I would say San Francisco has had a pretty broad policy initiative through the pandemic, while others have focused more on budget and reopening or distance learning. But they have been meeting, and you know, much of the controversy and scandals, if you will, on the school board have been based on some of these decisions, and like renaming schools or changing the admission policy to Lowell and things like that.
And they've also been meeting mm-hmm. more often. Jill, you might know more about how often the other school districts have been meeting, if they've ramped up their meeting frequency. But, you know, there's so many special meetings that they call in between the regularly scheduled meetings, which has started to ease off a little bit as the schools have reopened this past month. But they've had meetings roughly once, sometimes twice a week now, when normally it wouldn't be that quick.
Yeah, that's totally true. They typically meet for regular meetings at the second and fourth Tuesday of the month. And in between, they might have committee meetings and things like that. But they don't make decisions in those, typically, unless it's a committee of the whole where they might do that. But they've been having a lot of special meetings, you know, so you'll pretty much, as Ida said, every week, if not twice a week, meetings where they're making decisions or having conversations about significant policy issues.
Mm-hmm. And what's the relationship between the people who are making policy decisions, which sounds like it's the school board, and the people who execute it? Is that the district administration?
Yeah, there's a lot of, there's several deputy superintendents, and it seems to be who they communicate the most and who are part of these meetings, who the board, who they answer to the board, and the board asks them questions and sets direction. They don't have like legislation like the Board of Supervisors that they It's not the same structure as Jill said. It's more of like a guidance, and so based on what the board kind of indicates they want to see out of the administration is what the path that they go down.
Yeah, so they pass resolutions or pass the budget resolutions or contracts, but it's the administrative staff that implement the policies and make administrative decisions about how the schools are run. So you have an IT department, you have an HR department, you have just like any business or corporation or public agency, they're the folks who get things done based on policy decisions set by the board. Some boards are a little more hands-on in terms of that, and some boards are a little more hands-off, and you have depending on the personality of the superintendent who works for the board. Technically, the board is their boss. Depending on the personality of the superintendent, there's sort of a range of where the power structure lies or how much authority they give the superintendent to administer the policy.
Is there sort of mutual advisory that happens between the district and the board? Or is that generally a tense relationship? Is it more of a, like, as you say, like they're the boss and then the administrators are carrying out the policy? I guess a shorter way to ask this question is, who is in charge?
Well, I think it's a mutual relationship, where the superintendent is in charge of the school district, of the day-to-day operation of the school district, and the school board oversees all of that policy. In general, you're going to have a cooperative environment where, the superintendent and the school board, they're all at the board meetings together. The superintendent mm-hmm. is giving a lot of advice or his opinion of how the district should be run or not run. And then the board either takes that advice or not. These are independently elected individuals on the school board, so they answer to the electorate, not anyone else. But it depends, on the school board, how much they're going to listen to the superintendent that in some cases was hired before they got on the board, which is the case currently with the San Francisco School Board. There's only one school board member, Mark Sanchez, who was on the board when Superintendent Vince Matthews was hired. So, mm-hmm. you have sort of a range depending on the school district. I would say in this case, in San Francisco, there has been in the past year or two, some conflict between the superintendent and the board over the types of policies or over the priorities set.
Yeah, Ida, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, you can see that there has been some, oftentimes the board members will say, appreciate the work that you're doing and such. There have been times where, you can see that some of the board members are asking a lot of questions in a way that's like, why aren't we working on this kind of feeling? And, or why aren't we prioritizing mm-hmm. that? I would say how Jill laid it out is how it goes down, where the superintendent is the one who runs the day to day, and then the elected school board members kind of oversee what is going on and check in with that and maybe realign what they want. And Matthews hasn't even been there terribly long. And so, you know, much of the school board is relatively new. And Mark Sanchez is, as Joe mentioned, one of the longer running members on and off. But it's a fairly new board. Gabriela Lopez is president. Now Fauga Maliga is vice president. And Allison Collins, they were just took office in 2019, technically, Fauga in 2018. So they haven't been there for those are the older running members besides Mark Sanchez.
Yeah. I'm glad that you both brought up the electorate because, you know, as we've talked about, these are elected seats. I want to talk about the responsibilities of the board in terms of just time. Like, we've talked about long meetings already. How much of a time commitment is being on this board, and are the members compensated for that time? Do they usually have other jobs after they've been elected to this position?
Yes, this is not a full-time job for board members. They're unlike the city or the county supervisors, city supervisors, the school board is considered a part-time job. They're paid $500 a month for that role. And I mean, most have full-time jobs on the side, or many of them do. And you know, how much time they put into it is kind of individual. Usually the president ends up putting an awful lot of time into it because they have to set the agendas and they have to, you know, there's a lot of work that they do that's separate from the other board members. But, in general, there's a lot to read from every agenda, you know, the budget, understanding what's happening, communicating with constituents, pending in normal times, you know, openings or party or school festivities or things like that. You know, they're kind of out and about a lot, you know, but it is technically considered a part-time gig, if you will, that is compensated with $500 a month.
And as you can tell, you know, the demands of these roles have dramatically increased in the past year, as right. We talked about with the more frequent meetings. But in a recent review of the board policies, kind of set off by the superintendent's augmented contract to stay on for another year, the original rules were to, you know, end at 10, and if they have to go past that, then they have to vote and say so. And then that was, as Mark Sanchez noted, when they used to start at 6 p.m. So, you know, they were used to having roughly four hour meetings, which can, you know, tell you that there was probably less on there than there are less on those agendas than there have been in recent years.
I mean, this is a huge mandate. Like, they're setting policy for the entire district, and they're supposed to be able to do this in the four-hour meetings that they have every week or every other week. It seems like there must be more work going on outside of the meetings to get this
done.
Yeah,
there's often communications in between with the administrators. I don't know exactly what the level is, but, you know, they are communicating and asking about things and being informed about things. And also there's their now especially encouraged, again, under the superintendent contract, to ask questions related to those agenda items as much as they can before the meetings. There's definitely frequent communication between the board members and the school district staff.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that said, just to add a little perspective, I mean, their meetings are running regularly. They start at 3 and don't end until at times midnight. They're extending past that 10 p.m., you know, regularly, voting to keep going. And school districts elsewhere are not in that same situation, even though they're also dealing with the pandemic and things like that. There's definitely a perspective on this board, or in terms of the way the meetings are run and, you know, the types of things that they're bringing to the agenda right now that are taking up a great deal of time, that go well beyond sort of the legislating that a typical, you know, the public hearings and the legislating that a typical board might do. These meetings are extra long, even in the current climate, compared to many other schools.
And there's a lot that is brought to those meetings, too, that aren't necessarily an action. You know, it's a lot of reports from parent groups, so they can know how parents, there's like an English learners advisory group, there's an African American parent advisory council. So they want to be in regular communication with these groups to understand what the parents' priorities and you know, concerns and such are. And then there's other reports on like public safety or, you know, safety in schools with like suspensions and like all these sort of informational things to keep tabs on so that they can be informed about what policies to set going forward and continue to hear feedback from staff, parents, students, etc.
You're listening to a conversation from May 2021 with Jill Tucker, an education writer for the San Francisco Chronicle, and Ida Mojadad, education reporter for the San Francisco Examiner. I want to go back to the question of these folks being elected. I mean, from having covered elections and talked to school board candidates, it seems like scandal is actually usually the thing that draws attention to this body and to the elections for it. And otherwise, I don't get the sense that voters are necessarily always super engaged in this. I mean, way back before the pandemic, you know, two challengers decided to run against Jenny Lamb, who kept her seat because at the time the school board had made a controversial decision about the mural inside George Washington High School. In your experience covering this, have you observed the same, that there isn't often much interest in school board races outside of recent scandals? And if you have, why do you think that is?
Well, I think, you know, this is not just an issue that is now. I mean, this goes back virtually decades, if you will, in California and across the country. I mean, the reality is school boards are not considered, a sexy role in politics. Sometimes it's a jumping off point for people who want to run for higher office. But I think in general, just sort of if you think about when you go to the ballot box, you know, and you're supposed to vote for the judge, you know, the Superior Court judge. And you're like, I don't know, I guess if he's judge now, or BART board directors or whomever, right. You know, where, and school board members are like that. You can see it in the number of people that actually vote for school board members. It's lower than those who vote in general, you know, so that they're basically just not even checking those boxes when they go to the ballot box. They'll vote for the governor or the president, but you know, they just kind of leave those blank sometimes. You see that. But I think it's, you know, it's hard to get that information out. You don't have the following of those candidates like you would the mayor or the governor, you know, just because they're a much lower level, you know, in the political realm. And the reality is what has happened is that just the real quick history lesson that pre-Prop 13, school boards could raise local taxes. So there was a lot more interest in who was on that school board. Now, post Prop 13, you don't see business people or a wide range of people running for the school boards like you used to, because they have limited that power in terms of raising taxes and things like that. So really, you know, you have less of an interest in running for those positions, combined with sort of less experience in the people that might want to run for those positions. And then you also have a lot of special interests like the teachers union that are involved in endorsing and have a huge impact on the electorate. And so all of these things combined sort of lead into who runs for the school board and who is elected to the school board.
Ida, did you want to add to that?
That definitely is the lay of the land. A lot of that is also kind of changing really since the fall, I would say, like more of the parent groups have started to form to kind of organize around reopening, and different groups have been trying to get more involved politically as well to, you know, inform about the elections and provide sort of like guidebooks on who is running and such. So there's definitely been more interest in the school dynamics and politics around that I think will be really interesting to see how lasting that will be for future elections, even beyond these recall efforts that are happening, if more people are going to be interested in the schools permanently, or if it's because there's just heightened interest over reopening, and we'll just have to see when the time comes.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a greater awareness of how important the school board can be in a community. San Franciscans are realizing when there is crisis or when there is difficulty, the school board has a tremendous amount of power. I think people don't always recognize. And in normal times, and in a normal school board, you know, you don't see this. It is kind of a thankless job. You know, they're passing the budget. They're deciding where to make budget cuts. You know, all of these types of things that are kind of you know, behind the scenes of a school district, most parents are more concerned about who their principal is, who their teacher is, than who their school board is. And so, but I think that there is a greater awareness of the importance of the school board, which has always been there, you know, to direct policy and culture of a community, whether it's the textbooks that they adopt or other types of things. In other states, you had more conservative folks realizing that power and working to elect board members who were against sex education and teaching contraception to students. They wanted, you know, an abstinence-only education, and they elected school board members that were aligned with that. So there's definitely a lot of power in the school board when it is called upon, you know, or when they decide that they want to use that power. And we've definitely seen that in San Francisco with some of the policies that they've recently passed and their reopening.
I also want to go back to something you mentioned about how people sometimes go from the school board to higher elected office. Current supervisor Matt Haney served on the Board of Education before he ran for supervisor. So did Supervisor Shimon Walton. To my memory, this is not really unusual. I mean, former supervisor Sandra Lee Fewer and Jane Kim also served on the school board before becoming supervisors. Does this dynamic where people move on from the school board to try and pursue other offices, do you think that affects the makeup of the school board and its ability to do its work?
In some ways, yes, because, you know, as the United Educators of San Francisco has been more asking in their vetting of candidates, is asking them to stay for the full term, because some might try and run in between their tenures or during their tenures. And so they at least ask that they stay for a full term before getting the endorsement, and what policies they set forward, and whether they're, you know, more trying to kind of wedge their way into the city hall like power apparatus. That's also a criticism levied at the City College of San Francisco Board of Trustees as well at times. Right. And because that's a whole other topic for another day, but they also have a similar structure. Every time there's an election, you know, that's something that people have their mind on. Like, are they just using this to use it as a springboard? And there's also been a lot of people who have run in the past few cycles, like more than a dozen. It's a lot of people who are interested in running, and some who aren't really part of the school board community, or, like, you know, aren't as involved in the school board doings. And I think those who are paying attention are know who has been doing the work and who hasn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jill, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, there have been countless, you know, people. Norman Yee was another one. I mean, going back all these years, there's plenty that have moved on, which is not unusual. I mean, certainly that is the case in many communities. You start your political career, you know, on the city council or the school board, and work your way up into the state or whatever. So I don't necessarily think that that is something that is only happening in San Francisco. I think the question is, you know, who is getting that backing, who is being promoted through the ranks, you know, where that ultimate support and power coming from, and what does it mean for the candidates, you know, who, so, you know, if you are elected with the support of the DCCC and the teachers union, and you want to go for higher office, you know, you're going to need that support again. And so, you know, aligning with the power structure, as Ida said, is critical. It makes perhaps school board members who have higher office dreams more willing or desiring to answer to the, you know, the political structure, you know, or, you know, less independent, more aligned, because they can't lose that support if they want to move on. Whereas, you know, if you really just want to stay on the school board, once you're elected, you know, it's pretty unusual for an incumbent to not be reelected, because the voters just look at the thing and go incumbent and they check that box. But if you want higher office, you have to maintain those political alliances. And I think that then raises the question of how they're voting on the school board, whether they're voting independently and accountable to the electorate, or whether they're voting and accountable to the power structure.
Oh, there's more there to dig into, but I wanted to make sure that I ask about one other thing on this topic, which is the budget, because that's always an important thing when you're talking about government bodies. And the school district has, from what I can tell, $1 billion budget-ish, which is independent of the city's budget.
Yeah.
And it also, it looks like some of that comes from philanthropic dollars. Where in general does the school district's budget come from?
Well, the vast majority of it comes from the state and is is funded based on the enrollment of the school district and of the demographics of students. So school districts that have more English learners or low-income families and foster youth are going to get more money because of the needs of those students. But the vast majority of money comes from the state to cover teacher salaries, to cover classroom expenses, to cover, you know, all of the normal operations. But you also have a lot of federal money coming in, Title I money for low-income students, a lot of other types of money for special education and things like that, lunches, school lunches. And then you have local dollars that come from, there are some local dollars that come in that voters have passed in parcel taxes or bonds. And then you have philanthropic dollars that also come in. And then you have city money. San Francisco actually is very generous in sharing its money, the city of San Francisco, with the school district. And voters have passed many initiatives to, like, Prop H, which helps fund sports and libraries and art, you know, that flows into the district. And in many times, the Rainy Day Fund has been shared with the school district. During the pandemic, they shifted $15 million over to the school district. You know, so there's probably more city money flowing in to the school district than in most other communities. But the vast lion's share comes from the state.
I don't need to add.
Yeah, the enrollment is something that a lot of people are paying a lot of attention to right now because of the effect of the pandemic. And, you know, they lost a chunk of students, particularly those who are just entering the district, which, you know, could reverberate as those students get older. So depending on what the enrollment is, which we won't really know until October, then that affects the funding that they get. And for this past year, in terms of attendance, they've been like, the state has a hold harmless policy. So the attendance, it doesn't as much inform the funding, but you know, that will, I imagine, go back to normal. And there's just going to be a lot to iron out between, you know, adjusting to remote learning to being back in person, and how many students are actually in those seats is going to make a big difference. And they have a lot to to decide on over the summer with the budget, a lot of these unknowns. So
yeah, exactly. And Ida's right. Like, that, I think a lot of districts across the state, and especially San Francisco, which already is having a massive budget shortfall at the moment. You know, when you think about that, getting $10,000, give or take, per student in your district, if you lose 1,000 students or 2,000 students, you're talking a massive amount of money that is coming out of your budget, even though your costs are not necessarily changing.
Right.
And so, you know, you still have to keep the lights on. You still have to employ most of those teachers. It's kind of hard because if they're all coming from all the schools, you can't just cut the proportional number of teachers because maybe you're only losing 2 kids per classroom. So the costs don't necessarily decline, even as you're losing, they potentially could lose a massive amount of state funding because of enrollment declines.
And that's been an issue, a recent, you know, assessment statewide. It's not just SFUSD, it's in California, felt throughout California. So that will be whether families are returning to the public school districts or depending on where they move to, we'll see how families may have, you know, shifted their plans back or not, if they, you know, made a permanent change in where they send their kids to school.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think there are some really rough years ahead for San Francisco and many other districts. And I think it raises a point going back to the governance idea and the school board. You know, when you look at school board candidates, I don't think most of the electorate is looking at whether they are qualified to manage a $1 billion budget. I mean, you know, few CEOs are qualified to manage a $1 billion budget. And, you know, and most of the people that run for school board and are elected to school boards have no financial experience. You know, these are not people that are from the financial world or with a with an education in finance and budgeting. And so, you know, that raises a lot of questions about, you know, their ability to manage a budget, approve a budget. You know, thankfully, the people working in the school districts are the experts, you know, keeping the budget balanced. But, you know, that's always been something that I've been fascinated by, you know, over all these years, as who the electeds are and the lack of experience in finance. And, you know, it's very rare to have somebody on a school board with any experience in operating a budget.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. There's so much to talk about here, and there's so much that this body actually does. So I appreciate both of your reporting on this and for talking with me.
Thank you.
That was education reporters Jill Tucker at the San Francisco Chronicle and Ida Mojadot with the San Francisco Examiner in a conversation we had this past May. I'm Laura Wenis, and you've been listening to Civic. The Civic team is still crafting plans for how the show is going to look as we start our third year of programming, which is why you're hearing some conversations from our archives. If you want to help determine the direction we go in next, we'd love to hear your thoughts by filling out our listener survey. Thanks to those of you who have already responded. And if you have 5 minutes and some thoughts, go to surveymonkey.com/r/civiclisteners. Thanks.